You're listening to Policy Room by SPRF.
Hegel said that the only thing history teaches us is that people and governments have never learned anything from history. This statement still holds true for most decisions, rules, regulations, and laws passed in the name of public good by governments in contemporary times. Contemporary policymaking is not only inadequately informed by the discipline of history, but also relegates history to mere context settings. We hope to break this mold by exploring the relationship between public policy and history from a constructive lens. Professor Prabhu Prasad Mohapatra is joining my colleague Jitendra and I today. Professor Mohapatra teaches economic and labor histories at the Department of History, Delhi University. His interest in global labor history and modern social and economic histories led to his 2009 book, Labor Matters Towards Global Histories. It has also led to him establishing the Association of Indian Labor Historians, set up a fully digital and online archive of the Indian labor. Thank you for joining us today, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's an honor to have you on this podcast.
It's a privilege for me.
Often when we talk about policy, history seems to be divorced from it. It's always the context setting element and not the crux of our understanding. But most of the public policies in place today are a result of several historical events leading up to any policy's formulation. But public policy as a discipline must accept that it is planted in events of the past. B.R. Ambedkar and other predecessors of the current crop of policymakers echoed this understanding. But this notion today is lost on many in the public policy sphere. I just wanted to get your thoughts on this, Professor. If this had to be a discussion between a historian and a policymaker, what do you think a historian would say to convince the policymaker of this point, that history is essential to public policy?
Yes, that's very apt question to begin our conversation. Historians, the first thing we do is to look at archives. The archives are, as you know, most of the time, and the bulk of the archives that we do are archives generated by the state.
Yes.
It's interesting to see if you go to the National Archives of India and or in the India Office Library in Britain, the archives, the original policymaking files that we study for anything, any subject that we're doing, are yes. replete and in fact, specifically always indexed and connected to all precedents. That means no policy is ever made, at least in the 19th and 20th century, which did not explicitly look at the history of previous precedents of this. Part about doing history in the, at least in the colonial in British archives or colonial Indian archives, sometime later also in the till the 1950s, is the way they can open up for a historian a link to the past. Precisely because the policymakers, those who are deciding policies, are very, very explicitly recording the precedents. What was it done earlier? So, in fact, our historical understanding, we follow the path laid out by the policymakers by the way they cite evidence from the past by preceding decisions and so on. Even when it is making a radical break, a new, absolutely new policy, would not go without some precedents, or at least citing precedents. Okay, now in the current, at least for the last, from the 50s and 60s, and perhaps because we don't have access to records from the 70s onwards, we find less and less references to the past.
Yes.
It has actually begun from the 1920s, actually. One should say when there was a major shift after the First World War, for various reasons, for reasons of economy, for reasons of speed, for the kind of, as I would say, for more and more coming of technical, econo-technical expertise, which tended to sometimes disregard history, go on till disregard historical precedent, were much more interested because the rise of economic science in this period is very important for, at least for economic policy making. I'm not talking about foreign policy and diplomatic histories, where still the role of history is quite significant, but it's significantly reduced. Now, what's the logic of that reduction? I'm putting it in a global framework, global in the sense that wider framework, is that policy is now more and more, the horizon of the policy is short. It's interesting because even as we are faced with things like climate change, which are actually affecting you when the kind of historical aspects of climate change are so clear-cut. The policy making for a long time, at least say 50, 60 years, had been a kind of somehow blind to this. The shrinking of the horizon of the policymaking. Now, more and more, in a strangely, ironically, in a democratic electing, not say colonial period when there's no democratic elected governments, as the government's tenures become shorter in terms of that, policy gets disconnected from its, as more and more, so there are two points. One, more and more it becomes technical, ratio-technical, econo-technical. That means the so-called evidence-making based policy, which is coming into being now, but it's given a name, culling evidence in order to prove your policy, and the shrinking of the horizon of policy has retrospectively shrunk the role of historical precedence in this sense. Awareness of the global context, that means a larger spatio-temporal context in which each policy is located. That means we think the policy has only this impact is just like here. Do we see this? Do we see an immediate effect? And that's where we draw our conclusion and inferences. A lot of this survey and validations which are happening seem to really have a very short term, garner a longer term perspective. Now, this is, I'm saying, in a period of climate change, this will be easy to, at least very, very strongly to the policymaker that, look, your policy, your action today has consequences much larger than immediate, only 2 years, 3 years. Policy, at least the history of the last 150 years, 200 years, is so central to, locate each action. Now, no one can take a policy decision without somehow bringing into context this, intended and unintended. Policy is always an intended, coordinated set of actions, but it has unintended consequences. Now, this unintended consequences, to reduce the level of unintended consequences, is the aim of a good policy. And to reduce that, one needs to understand what has been the long-term unintended consequences. My teacher and great historian, Sarvapalli Gopal, was in the foreign policy, foreign ministry archives. He was handling the Indochina archives. So it was so crucial for India's diplomatic efforts to have a proper historical understanding of the complex issue of India-China border and so on. And a great historian, one of the biggest, best historian India had, was handling that. But now I don't see such historical sensibility. I may be wrong, but I hardly see any bureaucrat or with such kind of historical. A few bureaucrats who came from our historical traditions and they have done, but I don't know how much of the historical sensibility they really brought into their policymaking. I doubt that.
Do you think this attitude also comes from the notion that history can be done by anyone, like no historical training or no training in historical methods is required to do the context setting or just to do a background part of the policy that requires history? Do you think it also comes from that? And if yes, then what can be done to address that?
Well, this is that the idea of history obviously requires a kind of it's not a kind of a specialized witchcraft. The biggest shift of history has been its democratization. Yeah. Democratization means where people have a say in what their history is, or what, at least contest it in the public, not just be given it, but at least have a contestation. So that process is absolutely crucial for developing history, to take out of the straitjacket of government or state. So history, even though history is so crucial for the formation of the Indian modern nation states all over the world, in fact, history as a modern science, modern enterprise, is coincident with the rise of the nation state. That means history, as we know, modern historical understanding, has been coincident with that. Not to say that earlier there wasn't, before nation history, there were. But the modern form of history writing, which has gone beyond courtiers, chroniclers, and so on and so forth, acquiring kind of larger systematic, say, I won't call it scientific, but at least, there's no harm in calling it scientific in the sense, a most systematic and regular understanding of the past is a coincident with modern history. But as you rightly, you ask the question whether, or you want to know whether absolutely necessary that in order for historical, so a dilution of historical protocols investigation. There are like all forms of investigations, we need certain types of protocols. And those protocols are to be learned, are to be practiced. I don't say that only it can be learned only in the university or academia. It can be learned by testing it against well-established principles which against which it has to be tested. There is no escaping the fact that all historical knowledge must conform to certain type of, basic principles. In order to become historical, they must have these two principles simultaneously. There should be veridicality, that means they should approximate to truth in some sense. And second, it must be falsifiable. That means must be open to transformation and challenge and change by using certain protocols. What is falsifiable is the certain protocols are necessary. But if you generate from this knowledge statements in public, which cannot be verified on the one hand, or which cannot be falsified on the other hand. You understand, these two are slightly, they're not opposite functions. And what I mean, what I want to say is that despite all the abuses that we see in the public and which you are referring to, what it does is, and strangely enough, tends towards some of the protocols of history. So when people say, look, this is what Nehru said on this date, people would look at the selected works of Nehru, not to check it out. So history is a cruel mistress, as Frederick Engels once said, and that it advances by taking on what you don't expect. There is history is so much in the public today, especially for India. In India, history is everywhere else, but I think India especially, with its kind of peculiar or specific historical trajectory that India as a nation has undergone, is undergoing still, history plays a far greater role. And there, the public aspect of history is quite crucial. That's what the third function of history, which is in the policy-making realm we are coming back, is that this, to the extent that the policy is informed by the public discourse, not caused by the public, not respond only to, but informed by the public discourse, the way the public discourse history in public discourse takes place is crucial. In a way, some things are good because this democratization process is entrenching at least some principles, but also dangers of it, the subversion of the basic protocols. You have to draw the line of causality, the line of linkages between the past and the present. Merely citing the past does not at all. It may be a rhetorical device, but it is not it's not a policy instrument.
I think that's a good point to segue into the next question then. So because what we are trying to talk about here is to use history as a diagnostic tool, you know, not necessarily just as a context setting or even a, you know, rhetorical device. So if that is the contention, then certainly policy becomes a prescription. How do you see that unfolding in, you know, labor policy issues? To what extent can history be used as a tool to, you know, identify issues within labor policy that usually don't come under radar or, you know, skipped over in favor of other pressing issues or, you know, politically expedient issues, we can call them?
Being a historian of labor, and especially of the, I'm a specialist of the 19th century, I often have wondered whether there is actually policy relevance nowadays. Say, the shift, the massive changes which are being sought to be brought into labor policy in the recent years actually has strengthened my belief that there is a real, real necessity of bringing in history to inform policy making. So, first and foremost, let's see I'll give an example from the contemporary labor policy, which is the most important set of policy which is being brought out in the 2020s, okay, is the what is called the labor codes. It's a, in a way, claims to be a revolutionary set. That means it is bringing together a variety of labor laws which were disparate and which were created over time for specific purposes and then rationalize and harmonize them. Now, labor policy generally, since the 1920s at least, had more and more focused on a very, very specific set of relationship. That set of relationship was what we call employment contract, relationship of where employer and employer are in direct relation with each other, having mutual obligations and having mutual risks, which then the contract, through the help of the state, brings together and mutualizes their risks, generates a set of relationships where obligations are there and allows for open-ended relationship. Now, not aaj ke baad, kal nahi, no, today's thing, no. It's for a long-term relationship. Was generated because of the changes which were taking place in the world of industry and world of corporate organizations. You have the emergence of large corporate organizations. You had the emergence of mass production through assembly line chain. You had a kind of a control, with the control over the product control, which is necessary by the employers. You are also trying to kind of change to export to the world market. You are also getting resources from all over the world. So a new form of organization emerges, which we call the corporate organization. The large corporate organization emerges in the late 19th and early 20th century, which brings together this coordinated action in which the employment contract plays a great role, because you need predictability. You need control over the output. You need control over when you are doing mass production. Like, now, this particular set of relationships in India remained very small. It was only, never went beyond 12 to 13% of the total workforce. Rest of the workforce were kept out. Most commonly, the whole of agriculture was outside it. Whole of agriculture remained outside it, but also a huge mass of what we know as the informal sector. So the labor laws were disproportionately pointing towards the, or were applied to the formal sector. The context in which this is changing are twofold. On the one hand, the informal sector is increasing. Since the 1990s, with the liberalization and coming of neoliberal policies, direct employment relationships are being dismantled. For contractual relationships, you have, so instead of like, I am a service provider, rather than an employee, I become a service provider. These became the norm over the, so the laws actually, the labor laws which were fixed for the formal sector could not capture the shift which was happening in the underlying changes in the labor relation. And that's true. But think of it, from the 1990s till the 2020, 30 years now, we have had long-term changes in the labor relationship. And those policies which were built for another thing were not suitable for us. Now, whether the policy should be immediately changed in order to recognize these new changes, that's one point. But also to understand that all policies are themselves products of varieties of contending forces. Now, those balance of forces, that means force of various interest groups, these are played out in the policy. Now, you see this clearly in the labor policy, that this labor policy remained constant, that means had not changed since the at least the 1970s. Last time major change was done for 50 years, yet the underlying shifts have taken place. It brings into question the relationship between the formal policy and its actual effect on the ground. In this labor code, if you analyze that, there is a kind of deliberate eraser of history. What we instead have is cobbling together. That means as if it's a set of Lego bricks, which you can put together. Brick come from. You have taken it from a house which had been built over a long period of time. You have taken out a brick and created and made another. If you don't understand the process by which it has come, it will tend to be, it is what it is right now. It's a patchwork of badly cobbled up and continues to maintain the old problems. That means it tends to reproduce the old problem while giving it an appearance that we are actually universalizing certain aspects. So universalization of minimum wage, for instance, or so-called universalization of social security are being planned out. But as you can make out, if the building blocks have been brought from different elements and they have not, the contradictions inherent in them have not been sorted out. The intended consequence, now that's the point where the policy's intended consequence is twofold. It is proclaimed, but the most important intended consequence is signaling. The law is appearing merely as a symbolic signal to certain groups who are going to say, okay, we are putting out this, for instance, by taking out all the checks and balances which come from the for inspection, for instance, by making self-certification, by reducing compliance levels. All these are, they are more important than what exactly is being given as social security. This signaling is coming at a time when we are into another mode. We are not in the 1990s situation. We are not in the 2000 situation. We are in a midst of one of the longest and strongest crisis, economic crisis, which is global in nature, aggravated by COVID.
There is this history of marginalized communities, let's say by policy, historically kept outside of formal work or had barely any representation in it. The kind of new contractual ways of employment and just the precarity of, you know, work. How do you see, how can history sort of help in understanding these situations? So how do you see history helping us understand these for more representation, I guess, in formal employment, specifically for marginalized communities?
Yeah. Process of marginalization. One is marginalization, which is specific social marginalization. And another we could call a particular type of economic marginalization. That means precarity, social precarity and economic precarity being brought together in a modern temporary setting today. We find that that is the condition of most of the workers. Even in the formal sector, let me just tell you that more than half the workers, nearly half the workers, a little more than half the workers are what we call precarious, even in the formal sector. That means if you go to a large organization like, say, a steel plant or an automobile plant, less than 50%, in some cases 20-30% only are permanent, respiratory, varieties of forms of informality. That means they have less employment security, they have hardly any social security. Third problem which is arising now, which has become, I think, something which even policymakers are not getting full handle on, which has to be understood in a way largely, is the large number of people who are outside the labor market altogether. That means they are not even coming to work, what we would call redundancy or discouraged workers. The precarity which is emerging is that massive retreat of women from the labor market. We have one of the lowest female participation in labor market, historically the lowest now, one of the lowest in the last 3-4 years, and in global comparison, really low. If people are, say, that's not just amongst women, among scheduled tribes, among scheduled castes, a lot of people, socially marginal groups, are being marginalized further by being put outside the fold of the labor market itself. There is a necessity that people still are to be fed, to be given ration, free ration. It's been continuing. It's not out of any purely, it's a kind of a necessity it has become. How did the idea that everyone should have some social security and some degree of employment security, was it always like that?
Yeah.
But for a certain period of time, that standard was the golden standard. All the rights that which we see, first, the template of these rights, social rights, citizenship rights and all, were provided by workers' rights. Now, how did that come about? That's where, if you can say, history can teach us something. Now, these become the template for giving dignity to the most marginalized group also. Giving dignity to manual labor, to wage labor, which was considered the worst or the most precarious form of existence, slowly over the 19th century and 20th century, as I told you, this became solidified. That allowed for the expansion of what we call social rights. So today, Dalits and say various other marginalized groups who are have actually, and that is what Dr. Ambedkar also very strongly, because remember, Dr. Ambedkar was the law member. He was the original labor policy maker of India. And he set up several institutions and the several laws. Actually, he drafted several laws, became the bulwark of what we call the labor governance architecture. It's strange, not just strange, it's interesting to see when he conceptualized labor, he thinks of labor as something which overcomes caste. So he saw this as a concurrent process. In fact, consequent process. That means first you put people out from the rural society in which most of the caste operation happens, bring them into the industrial sector in which you have the possibility of application of labor law. emancipate labor from its both from its thraldom in social thraldom and economic thraldom. Throughout the world, there was this imagination which was coming. Soviet Union's existence, the fact that there was the Keynesianism was the most important political economic thinking which was coming into being, in which workers' income and giving workers a good income was seen as a solution to a crisis, not the cause of the crisis. Question to ask, as I said, Jitendra, you asked this question, I want to answer it quickly, that historically we need to go back to say, how come all these rights were given to workers in a bad condition, relatively weaker economic condition? Why? Yeah. For that, if once you answer that, and then see that in a much more, in a situation where productivity of workers are rising rapidly, mechanization, automation is happening rapidly, what is it that stops people from giving a higher share to workers? It has been seen that workers had too many rights. Too many rights. And that has stopped investment. And so we must curtail workers' rights in order to get investment. The imagination is necessary. Today, when there is rapid change happening, we must bring together a new imagination. Learn from the past. But we have a new challenge. Automation is a major challenge. Or not challenge, it's a, both a challenge and an opportunity. Automation, climate change, where new green jobs have to be imagined, better paying, solid, less carbon jobs should be brought in together. Income inequalities are causing problems. It should be learned as not as solutions. Civilizational structures, we take out all the bad things of that civilization, but we must maintain and retain certain aspects of the civilization, because the answer to global climate change doesn't lie in further mechanization of life, ecologically sensitive and ecologically responsible life. And these, which are based on promotion of profit and greed, are completely against the civilizational ethos of India, but also the world spirit. And it has become a necessity. It is no longer an ideal. It is a necessity now. And then devising policies which will have less unintended consequences will become possible.
Thank you for this great discussion, sir. Do you have any sort of words or suggestions for, as a labor historian or just a historian general, to public policy practitioners, think tanks, consultancies, etc., on how to mainstream historical perspectives in their work, and more importantly, how to sort of get historians into the policy research space?
I have very little to say to that. I've always said that policymakers have a responsibility to learn from history. So if we do our job well as historians, policymakers, and as the policymakers do the job well, they will. Writing good history is my responsibility or our responsibility. Making good policy and devising policy, appropriate, relevant policies is the job of policymakers. Historians cannot step into the shoes of policymakers. Neither can policymakers become historians. Precedents, protocols. And that means protocols of truth and falsification, both, which are historically generated, you know. And that means suiting your what your policy is already determined. Third, of course, is the public. So three P's, I'm just saying, public discourse. That means informed about public discourse, informing public discourse. So that means the relation between policy making and public discourse, and a public discourse which will affect policy, or at least will respond, is very crucial. Developing all these sensibilities would be the first step in historical understanding. Is not just putting the past here, but understanding the past in its context. That understanding that past too has a history. History is not all past. If we understand that, that means every, like my present has a past, the past also has a past. Past has its own history. Present has, the future has its own past. There are certain about conscience, about compassion. About compassion, about feeling for the marginalized, those who are left behind. That must be absolutely crucial for policymaking. And that, I don't think, you know, that can be taught in religion, taught by philosophy, but history also, if I say, it's up to you to how to bring the compassionate aspect of history, the cruel aspect of history, the one which, you know, which promotes a get rich quick, and how it has led to lack of compassion for fellow beings and And a third is big. So like Gandhi's criterion that any policy, the touch mark of a policy is how it affects the poorest, the last man standing. That important. Second criterion, that is, I'm talking of history as its precedence, as a protocol, as a public, but also the last man standing principle. You have to use that. And the second is, how is it leading to long-term sustainability? That means, how does it, every policy must go through the fate of humanity. That means it's not my nation's fate, not my village's fate, not my political party's fate. We cannot live without taking back the global perspective that we are facing a crisis of humanity. If it is there, if all policies today have this, at least learn from history in this form, without replicating history in its kind of way, purely, but having a historically informed, and put these two ethical criteria, which I think is necessary for, not just for, I'm not just saying for policymakers, they're for historians also. I'm saying that for historians also, these two are the ethical principles must be there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think that's a perfect place for us to close. Thank you, Professor Mohapatra. Thank you for your valuable insights on how policymakers can use history to be better informed and come up with better policies. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for tuning into another episode of Policy Room, produced by the Social and Political Research Foundation. SPRF is a youth-oriented public policy think tank based in New Delhi, working to spark dialogues for a better democracy. Stay tuned for more episodes coming soon.